there's this idea of reflection and reconsidering the past and where I've come from and who I might be, the things that I'm, sort of might be disappointed in myself with. But nonetheless, I hope my rider knows my name. I hope that the person that I'm in intimate relationship with, or I hope that God knows who I am and knows my name. As the song goes on and I get to the third verse, and I'm sort of in the valley of the shadow of death, and I'm facing, the future, and I'm facing the abyss, it turns into not, I know my rider knows my name, but I hope my rider knows my name, because ultimately I have doubts, right?
Right.
And I wonder, does is God watching me? Does God know my name? Or if I'm talking about human relations, can we really communicate with each other? Are we really able to see each other and to hear each other and to hold each other? Sometimes I don't know. And so I hope we do. I hope my rider knows my name.
Welcome, 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 everyone. I am Naama Segal Karas, and this is How Do You Jew, the podcast that highlights the diversity of the Jewish experience so that we can love our fellow like ourselves and we can get Mashiach already. I
Absolutely.
have with me an amazing, incredible Jew. He is, I don't know if I'd say a Renaissance man, or maybe, I don't know, like an Enlightenment man, or, Industrial Revolution man. He knows a lot of things. He is very good at many things. And I just to name a few, he's a poet, he's an author, he's a musician. He is a observant Jew in his way, which is all I care about. And he also just cares deeply for the Jewish community, both locally, I know, and worldwide. So without further ado, this is Ethan Davidson.
How's it going?
Thank you
Yay.
so much for being here. I'm
Well, thanks
so
for having
psyched.
me. Thanks for having me,
So
Nama.
now tell me a little bit about this incredible ensemble I'm seeing here. There's like a really cool tie with like maybe a bolo or something on it. And then
Oh,
I've got like the hat here. What is this?
some little, I don't know, piece of silver here. It's funny, I didn't think about it until just now, but I was reading on the daf today in Shavuos. There was a bit about, if it's a financial oath, it's, has to be worth at least two silver paruta or something like that anyway. And I was just like, oh yeah, I got one piece of silver here. So
Got to keep something on me at all times.
it's something to remind us of the daf, exactly. But
That's
yeah,
funny.
just a, and then a just a cowboy t-shirt and a, I spared you the cowboy hat today, although I wear lots of hats, so.
I love, well, and I'm that's like figuratively and literally.
Right,
I
exactly.
also noticed there is kind of a an affinity for the Wild West in your motif a little bit. Is that true?
Well, I mean, I grew up, partly on the western slope of Colorado. My father had an old cattle ranch out there. We didn't have cattle, but it was an old, the buildings were from like the 1870s or something like that. So, that always felt a little bit like home to me, out west. And of course, I lived in a rural community in Alaska for a while. So when I'm sitting here in Detroit, which is a great city, I'm like, and I like being in Detroit, but I'm also sort of like, where's my horse? Where are my mountains? I gotta dress like a cowboy and walk the streets of Detroit.
I gotta tell you, it hasn't been until this exact moment that you said that that I correlated two different facts. The first is one in six cowboys in the West was a Jew. The second is
Well,
that we are the original lonely cowboy out in nature talking to God
for
because
sure,
of Heath
for
Budadut.
sure. Keep what to do,
So,
exactly.
like, I wonder if that was like the plan the whole time. Like, Hashem invented Heath Budadut so we could have lonely cowboys and lonely cowboy songs.
Rav Nachman was a lonesome gun-slinging cowboy.
Oh my gosh, get along, little doggy. All right.
Exactly.
So that's amazing. I love that. I want to hear that story too. But like I said, I want to be mindful of your time. I know
Sure.
you have a million things going on. So as most of my listeners, all three of you know, you know, this podcast was the brainchild of me being sick of waiting for Mashiach. And if there's something I can do to get Mashiach right now, I'm going to do it. So V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha is
absolutely
like it's in a poster above my head. Like it's everything I do all the time. I'm not here to judge. I'm here to love. And I wanted to highlight amazing Jews who are doing Judaism differently. And literally you were the first person in my mind when I thought of this podcast, because you Jew differently than everybody else. And I love that. And I know you give Hashem so much nachas from it, because you are walking the path that was carved for you. So before I get into everything, I do want to hear a little bit about your origin story. Can you tell us about yourself, where you're from, what you're doing now, and how your Jewish identity kind of shapes you?
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I wasn't born Jewish, you know, to be honest. I was born in I was, you know, raised in a Jewish family, adopted by a Jewish family at birth, but it was like a far left wing Marxist anti-government commune from a group called the Weather Underground. And they were the, you know, this was the group that bombed the, I'm not saying that this is something that you should do. I'm against violence, but this was, the group that bombed the 1968 Democratic National Convention. So
yes, I know
Chicago.
That story. Wow.
So that's where I was born. My biological mother was a teenage girl, and her sister was part of the Weather Underground. So they had, you know, a doctor in common with the family that ultimately adopted me. And so I ended up, the irony is that my biological mother's family, she and all her sisters married, they ultimately all married Jews. So they all also became
Hashem
Jews.
Got Hashem's way.
Exactly.
One way or the other.
They all became Jews one way or the other. But so I was adopted into a Jewish family. You know, the rabbi who, you know, handled my, you know, conversion, such as it was as an infant, was Rabbi Erwin Groner of blessed memory. He was educated at the Skokie Yeshiva. So, you know, he came originally out of an Orthodox world, and our family was traditional, although it, you know, evolved over time as families often do. You know, I think for the longest time, it was really just my father and me, and our, you know, home became more, you know, it was very kosher when I was a kid, right? But things go through their own evolutions.
Of course.
I went to a Jewish day school, you know, as a child, and we were very involved. My father was very involved in a local, well, Shaar Tzedek, Congregation Shaar Tzedek, which I know you're familiar with here here in Detroit. He was the president of Shaar Tzedek, as was his grandfather. And so he was very dedicated to the Jewish people, you know, I wouldn't describe him as a religious man, but he was very he was very Jewish, and had, you know, that Yiddishkeit was something that was just, you know, he had it in his bones, right? It
right.
was, he, you sort of, you meet people that maybe they don't necessarily study, but they have, you know, these texts sort of already written on their being, on their fiber. So my father was written in their bones. And that was really, my father, Alav Shalom. He really had that. So, and you know, there wasn't a Jewish high school. There wasn't a non-Orthodox Jewish high school when I was growing up, not locally. And so then I went to public school. I was always interested in religion and philosophy. And you know, my family all thought that I would grow up to become a rabbi.
Well, that's always the hope, isn't it?
That's always the hope. Although actually they, you know, A lot of my family members didn't necessarily want that, but I will be getting smicha later this year. So.
Are you serious?
Yeah, for sure.
Where are you getting smicha from?
Well, a friend had, a couple of friends over the years that I study with had asked me, why don't you get smicha? And I've kind of dismissed it. I'm like, look, some people call me rabbi. They think I'm a rabbi, whatever. That's fine. I'm like, I don't need a title or anything. But a friend in Chicago, Rabbi B'nai Lape, had asked me, and if I would do that. I said, look, I can't come to Chicago and go through your whole program there. And she said, no, you don't have to, with your books and everything, and you're already doing rabbi. You just have to tell me if you want smicha. So I came back and asked a couple of friends around here. I asked Rabbi Asher Lepatin and a few others, in the Orthodox space, what do you think? And they said, well, you tell her yes. Why don't you just, you get smicha, whatever, to tell her yes. So I went back and told her yes. And so I'll get smicha this, later in August. So I guess I'll officially be.
Right in the lead up to Elul and Tishrei.
That's right. Exactly.
Wow. Did you ever think you would walk into Tishrei with smicha?
No, I guess I hadn't really, like I said, over the years when people have suggested it, I kind of like, well, whatever. It's not. Look, seriously, the thing is like, if people, if people think you, community thinks you're a rabbi, they call you rabbi, they come to you for advice and you really want, or they come to you for learning or whatever, and you really want to do your best to sort of ask the right questions and help them where it seems that they need help, you want to take that kind of stuff seriously, right?
Of course.
And if they want to call you rabbi because of that, because they think that you've done a good job sort of helping them through whatever it is that they need help with, then great, then you're doing rabbi. And at least to me, because I kind of view it as a which comes to my whole Jewish practice and music practice, is it's part of like a psychotherapy practice for me. And I use the Jewish texts as part, as a tool to unlock those things inside of us that we might not be completely aware of, or where we may have blockages. So if I'm, really sincerely trying to help people to the best of my ability in that way, and people then identify that as being somehow like doing the rabbi thing. Okay, well then, okay, fine. I guess I'm a rabbi, so fine.
Well, it also sounds better than guru. Like guru Ethan sounds bad, but like rabbi Ethan sounds really good. Plus the parking at the front of the building is always really nice.
Yeah, it's always good. Well, I'm only in it for the parking space.
I would be too. Same. So now I heard a little birdie tell me that you have a new book.
Yeah.
I would love to hear the title and what inspired you to write it.
Well, I have a new book. The title is, I want to give a trigger warning, I guess, because the book is about sexual violence in the Jewish texts. And it's my translation of a pasuk in Parsha Ketisa. So the title of the book is, "And They Arose Early to Do Sexual Violence." And so it deals with it, which is my translation.
Is from the Parsha. He did not come up with that title himself. That is from Torah.
That's from Torah. And that's from, it's my translation of Torah. It's in the episode of the Golden Calf, and I'm translating the word there that's tzachek as sexual violence. And I bring in, Chazal and other classical commentators to make the case of why I'm translating the word that way. It's a subject that I've studied for years in Chavrusa, and it was interesting to me for various reasons, which I go into at the beginning of the book. And I thought over the years, I'll write a book on this subject at some point. And then what happened was October 7th happened, and in particular, the sexual violence that was a component of the Hamas attacks, which was either you know, sort of dismissed by, you know, some non-Jewish friends of mine or also people in positions of power. They said there wasn't any such thing as sexual violence. Or what was even worse, I think, was when people in positions of power wanted to contextualize that violence and say, well, yes, there was sexual violence, but you have to understand, you know, like, this is what happens. And as if, like, as if sometimes, you know, sexual violence is justified. And I'm like, well, no, wait a minute. It's never justified, first of all. Right. So, and I think, you know,
it really isn't.
No, it really isn't. And I was like starting with the assumption that, like, you know, all reasonable people on the planet, whether they're Jewish or Christian or Muslim or Buddhist or whatever, you know, should be able to say sexual violence is always bad, period, full stop.
You know, you would think.
So I wanted to, you know, so at the beginning of the book, I talk a little bit about October 7th, but I didn't want to write, you know, really a political book. I wanted to say, look, I'm writing this because of this. And I want to explore episodes of sexual violence in the text, and then even more importantly, how do we respond in those texts to the sexual violence? And
meaning, you know, in the moment in the parsha, or us as the reader reading it now in present day?
No, in the parsha and in another of our classical texts, you know, and to help us unpack, what are the appropriate limits of that response? I mean, if somebody attacks us, we have a right slash obligation to prosecute, you know, those criminals. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, obviously, that takes, you know, the form of a war, when it's not just a RODEF, but when it's an attacking, you know, force, right?
Right.
And yet, often in the texts, because these are texts, you know, our classical texts are texts that reflect the human reality, is even in those cases, sometimes those responses can spiral out of control themselves. I mean, we think about, you know, the rape of Dina, or we think about sexual violence at the end of the Book of Shoftim, at the end of the Book of Judges. And then I bring in the classical commentators to comment on those episodes. And it's interesting because in the case of the rape of Dina, you have commentators like Maimonides, like the Rambam, who ultimately says, no, these, you know, the people of Shechem had an obligation to bring their prince to justice for raping Dina. So they were all culpable in some way. And so Shimon and Levi had a right to prosecute them. You have another commentator, like the Maharal of Prague, who softens it somewhat, but ultimately he too finds the subjects of Shechem somehow culpable, right? You have others like Nachmanides, the Ramban, who says, no, these people were, you know, innocent subjects of Shechem. They would have been afraid to bring this prince to justice. You know, it was wrong for Shimon and Levi to massacre the entire population. And I was introduced to a book, I'm looking at it right now, which I only came across after I wrote my book, written by a woman called Athalia Brenner. It's called I Am, Biblical Women Tell Their Own Stories. And she writes in the voice of Dina in this book. And I found it very interesting because Brenner makes the case in Dina's voice that, no, look, Shimon and Levi were the only ones who stood up for me. I absolutely, you know, respect that they massacred this population. And, you know, I think Brenner's take was pretty interesting there. I don't know, you know, that that's where I come out, but look, it's a point of view. And I mean, and a woman sort of deals with this kind of violence or is subject to this kind of violence, I can appreciate where Brenner is coming from on that, you know, that my father Jacob, you know, was trying to make deals, and Shimon and Levi, you know, took the matter into their own hands. So my book is about those kind of things, you know, the sexual violence or any kind of violence like that where we're attacked, our obligation and our right to defend ourselves or to defend others from that kind of violence. And then what do our sources say about the limits of what's appropriate and what's not appropriate? And I'm not coming up with answers necessarily. I'm just wanting to raise the question so that we can have discussions about it. And I've been on this book tour on and off over the last year, and the discussions have been great. They've been sober, they've been serious. There hasn't been any disruptors, thank God. And the book ends up in a positive place about healthy relationships. So it's not all dark.
And you said you weren't sure if you should be a rabbi. Really? Well, come on. Well, of all the topics in Torah you could wrestle with, you picked that to write a book about?
Yeah.
You are clearly a rabbi in a cowboy hat.
In a cowboy hat, exactly.
Yeah.
The Frisco Kid, if you remember that. That one with Harrison Ford and
Kid
Andrew
Rabbi.
Wilder. Yeah, exactly.
So now this actually begs the question.
Yeah.
As a Jew who does his Judaism in his own unique way,
yeah.
What are you wrestling with when it comes to Torah and Judaism? And what is it that you're in love with about Torah and Judaism?
Oh gosh, there's a lot that I wrestle with in the texts. I mean,
Same.
A lot of wrestle, you know, and it's here. So here's my thing, I guess, a way of, you know, zooming, if I zoom way out with the with the texts, and what do I wrestle with? I approach them. I mean, okay, so I find things in the text that really bother me, and I find things in the text that I really disagree with sometimes, and I wish that they weren't there.
Yeah.
Right. Whatever they may be. Right. And
so say we all.
We all. Yeah. Exactly. And. But what I decided years ago was, how am I going to approach those kind of things? I mean, on the one hand, I could say, well, look, these texts were all just made up. You know, the documentary hypothesis, there's like four or five different texts that have been edited and stitched together. And it was all just written by some guys sitting in some caves. And they just made this stuff up. And I could hold that view. And so then I could dismiss the really problematic things and just say, well, it's not real anyway. It was just, but I decided years ago that I wasn't going, you know, whether or not that's true, I decided years ago that that wasn't going to be my approach to it, because I didn't want to give myself a get out of jail free card with the text in that
you
way.
You wanted to make yourself wrestle.
Yeah, for sure. I wanted to
give
myself.
I love that so much. I am of the same mindset.
Yeah. I mean, you have to, I think at least for me, I don't want to say you, but at least for me, the stuff that makes me uncomfortable, I want to like run towards it. Right.
Yes. And that's literally what I tell my coaching clients. If it scares you, run towards it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so then I take the point of view that, okay, it's not written by a bunch of guys in caves. It's not like, it's a divine text, you know, handed down from God through Moshe at Sinai. And that takes away my get out of jail free card. And so then I may still be really uncomfortable with many things in the text, and I may not find a way out, you know. But at least I feel like I'm being more honest about it that way.
Is there any, other than obviously the subject matter of your book, is there any other, could you give an example of something that you've wrestled? I ask this in particular because my hope is that the Jews that do tune in and listen, maybe they haven't really thought much about their Judaism, and they're listening to these stories to understand they have full permission to be as much of who they are as they can be. And if there's a nugget of something that bugs you, it might bug them too, and they still have permission to Jew as much as they want.
For
Is there
sure.
Any example you can come up with?
Well, there's, I'll mention really quickly a couple of like sort of to me obvious easy ones, and then I'll get to one that I'm working on for
a new
book, God willing. You know, there's the obvious, to me, the obvious easy ones that are like, the Jews have just come out of slavery in Egypt, right?
Right.
And then God says, and then when you have a slave, you know, it's like, wait, hang on, wait a minute. Like, I thought we just got rid, like, why are we having slaves now? Anyway, so that's one thing. Or you can have sort of things in the Talmud that, you know, about whether women can give testimony in court, or this whole idea about, you know, women are not obligated in time-bound mitzvot because they're not masters of their own time and their own schedule. And I'm thinking, well, okay, but, you know, what if you're, you know, I mean, the CEO of General Motors is a woman, so she's not like, you know, she's not Jewish, but Mary Barra, so she's not the master of her, she runs General Motors, for crying out loud.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So, exactly. Right?
She's not qualified to give testimony in court. I mean, come on, right? So yes. There's those kind of things. But I, so the thing that I'm wrestling with now, and I've been studying for a couple of years, and I've started writing what, God willing, will be a book, is the story of the blasphemer that occurs in Leviticus chapter 24. And the it's one of the two narrative sections in the book of Leviticus. And the story as it appears in Leviticus is very economical, let's say. We don't get a lot of detail. But there's a bunch of rabbinic literature on this guy. And we don't know his name. What we know is that his mother was an Israelite of the tribe of Dan, and but his father was Egyptian. So he's a person of complicated identity. And I think this is like really relevant for today, when people's identity, you know, can be, people can have multiple identities, their identities can be fractured in some way, either because, you know,
there's overlap.
They come from a mixed household, or they have, you know, or it's a gender identity thing or sexuality, where they can have fractured identities in lots of different ways, or complicated identities in lots of different ways. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think this character is a character that can really speak for our time. He's a person of complicated identity. He doesn't fit like in the, he doesn't, you know, doesn't seem to fit into the larger community. He has he's at the back of the line in the desert. He's been brutally attacked by Amalek because he's identified as an Israelite, right? And other things that sort of he has to endure through his life, which are really put him in a very vulnerable situation. So at some point he decides, you know what, my mother is over there with the tribe of Dan. I want to be with the tribe of Dan. And he approaches the tribe of Dan, tries to pitch his tent there. And they said, no, you can't join us, because to be a member of the tribe of Dan, your father has to be from the tribe of Dan, but your father was an Egyptian, so you're not allowed to be here. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, yeah, but look, I've just been like brutally attacked over here.
I just got my butt handed to me for this people. Can't for you this let people. Me in?
Yeah, can't you let me in? And, you know, it leads to a fight. You know, in the rabbinic literature, it turns out that, you know, people say really nasty things about his mother. And he takes his case to Moses. And it's interesting because Moses is also a person of complicated identity.
He sure is.
He's Israelite, but his wife is not an Israelite. His
and
children
he was
are
raised as an Egyptian.
And he was raised an Egyptian. So this guy, the son of the Egyptian and the son of the Israelite woman, he goes to the court of Moses and he says, you know, makes his case. Mm-hmm. And and ultimately he's ruled against. You know, Moses says, I can't help you, you know.
Yeah.
And the guy freaks out and he blasphemes God, and they take him out and they execute him. And it's like, wait a minute. Like, really? There was no, you know, and it's like, you know, I get that the law is the law. Okay, you know, tribal affiliation is, you know, is patrilineal. You know, Israelite identity is matrilineal, but to be a member of a tribe, your father has to be of that tribe. So I get it. But there's no other way we could find a home for this guy. He's looking for community, he's looking for protection, he's looking to not be vulnerable anymore. We couldn't help him in some kind of way. you know?
Yeah, and I'm biting my tongue right now. I have so much to say.
Right.
And yes, and then what do we do for children of rape? And what do we do for, you know, all of these victims of war and all of these circumstances that we're supposed to be showing rachamim and we don't?
That's right.
I resonate with your struggle.
Yeah. And so that's a tough one. A friend of mine down in, in the Yeshivish part of the community down here in Oak Park, I was talking about this with him the other day, and we got into that question of like, can't you help that guy? And so my friend said, he said, look, it's interesting because when you come later to the story of the daughters of Tzolofchad,
yes,
they're coming to Moses with a problem too. They're saying,
right,
our father didn't have any sons. He only had daughters. The law does not allow us to inherit our father's property.
Mm-hmm.
And so the law is the law. And that could be the end of the story. But in that case, Moses does go, asks God, and they find a solution for these women that, they can inherit their father's property. And so my friend was saying, maybe that represents some kind of an evolution in Moses's thinking, is that he's like back in that place with the blasphemer. And he's like, we're not going to do that again, where we said, no.
Well, yeah. In the first story, he doesn't go to God and say, listen, I need you to do me a solid. The second time he does, which means he was growing some courage.
Exactly.
And I love that interpretation. Thank you for giving me something positive to end that on. Oh my gosh. Now tell me something, just one.
Sure.
Just one thing you love about Torah and being Jewish and Judaism.
Oh gosh. I mean, I love, there's a lot of love. I think the big holiday here for us, probably the one that resonates with me more than anything, is Sukkot. So I do love, being in there with the kids and sleeping out. And I know we're a long way from Sukkot, but, that's a big one around here. I mean, I love being with people in real time and in real space and just being together, especially in that place where we have nothing but the stars above our heads.
Back to the cowboy sentiment.
Exactly.
I am so biased. I love being able to count the stars and look at the moon and being like halachically obligated to do it. It feels so good.
It does.
That's just a thing. I completely agree. So now, in terms of your love affair with Torah, you've described Torah as a mirror. So what are some reflections that surprised you when you were writing your book?
Well, I think, where I came, where I started to really think about that idea was a couple of years ago. And I write about this in the first book, which is called These Are the Developments of the Human. And by the way, if your listeners, want, they can contact me in a private message on social media, and I'll tell them how to get the book, because I don't sell them through like normal channels. But so in the first book, I write about this mirror idea. It was really, when I read the first couple of verses of Genesis, the first couple of Psalkim of Bereshis, I it's about the creation of the world. There's dark, there's a void, God's face is hovering over the surface of the deep, whatever any of that means.
Mm-hmm.
And then God says, let there be light, or maybe let there be conscious awareness or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, that's all great. I don't, the creation of the world, yeah, I get it, but I don't know, that doesn't relate to my experience because I'm living in a created world here.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to think, the human is created in the image of God, right? So let's separate that, God at the beginning for the human, maybe we can do a transposition there. And then I thought, okay, well, what's the fathomless dark depth that my face is hovering over? I'm like, well, that's maybe my interior psychology. There's things about myself that I don't know or that I don't understand. There is like unexplored corners of my heart, and my face kind of hovers over that fathomless depth. And I say, you know, let me bring conscious awareness to that depth and then be able to then start to be able to name things. You know, this is dry land and this is sea, or this is this kind of feeling, or this is how I react in this kind of situation. And I begin to like put names to those things and begin to understand them. And so I realized like what I'm doing in that process then is sort of looking at myself in a mirror, looking at myself in an X-ray mirror, if you will, and begin to understand what motivates me. Why do I react this way in this kind of situation? And where do I learn about those kind of things in the text? And how does the text help me to unpack some of these things?
So you're basically describing comparing on the macro, Hashem evolving the light and the dark into all created matter, and then siphoning it down as a micro comparison to the journey towards self-identity and evaluating and self-awareness of self-identity.
Exactly.
Because there's that space between I know who I am and I don't know who I am. There's the discovery piece of it where you have to even become conscious of the fact that you're walking the path of becoming aware.
That's exactly right.
That's so interesting. I love that.
That's exactly right. So that's what I mean about it being a psychotherapeutic tool.
It sounds like it. It definitely does. It sounds like it might help even more people than I initially thought. Wow. Yeah. Now I do have to do the thing because it's the name of the podcast. So let me ask you.
Yeah.
In your own unique way, I want to know, how do you do? How do you bring your own unique flavor of Judaism and your neshama to the world and in your everyday life? How do you do, Ethan Davidson?
How do I do? Well, there's a couple different ways. I mean, I work for my father's, my late father's, family foundation.
Mm-hmm.
We do a number, that's the William Davidson Foundation. And you know, as we, among other things we do, I think our central work is around Jewish education, Jewish literacy, Jewish mm-hmm. community. Mm-hmm. And so one of the ways in which I Jew was because of working there, although I had been studying all kinds of different religions, all kinds of different philosophies, both in college, grad school, and whatever, I decided, okay, well, I need to now really focus on my own Jewish learning so I can be the most Jewish. If I'm going to make decisions about Jewish education, I have to be like the most Jewishly educated, right?
Right. That's just a matter of accountability.
That's just a matter of accountability, right? I feel like I wouldn't be doing my job responsibly if I weren't as Jewishly literate as I could be, right? I
want to realize how uncommon a mindset that is, right?
Yeah. So I don't know, but I want to be good at my job. Right.
That's so fantastic. I'm in awe of that sentence alone.
So that's one part of it. That's one part of how I do. And then I think the other thing is really with either the writing and or the music, that's again all part of my psychotherapy practice. A lot of the, not all of the song lyrics, but a good number of the song lyrics are sort of Jewishly informed. It's not Jewish music per se, but I'm lifting things from the texts and sort of coding them in this Americana music. And so it's there if it's there, it's there to be found by the listener. And again, it's part of my psychotherapy practice, but I want to do that practice, publicly, right? So it, because it's also a way to, hopefully meet people. And I'm not just trying to entertain people. I'm trying to do that as well, I guess. But the most important thing is to, that maybe something that I've said or put forth in a song really resonates with somebody. And they say, I feel that same way too. I've had that same struggle too, and I develop a relationship with that person, and that's happened from time to time. So when people say,
do you find that like when you drop these breadcrumbs in the lyrics in the book, Because, you know, in 500 years, some new Chazal is going to go, okay, well, Rav Davidson wrote this book. And in this one, he dropped this hint. And the pardes of this means this. So like clearing it up for future generations, is it haphazard? Or do you choose these bits and pieces that you convey because you want to teach an idea or an ethic or tell a story or trigger a reflection in the listener?
Yeah, I think it's all those things trigger a reflection. Sometimes I want to tell a story through the song. I was thinking about I have you know, the first song on my new album that just came out in the last couple of weeks is a song called "I Know My Rider Knows My Name," and it's an Americana. You know, the music is just straight Americana kind of music, and what I was thinking there, just to give you an idea of my approach, is, you know, rider, in Mississippi blues kind of vernacular, rider is like a sexual partner. I'm not talking about a sexual partner in this case. I wanted to use that word, but I'm using it not that way. I'm using it just as a stand-in for an intimate relationship, in this case, an intimate relationship with God. Or an intimate relationship with, you know, the person that I'm in an intimate relationship with, my wife, or anybody else that who I love. And so the song kind of goes through, and there's, you know, this idea of reflection and reconsidering the past and where I've come from and who I might be, the things that I'm, you know, sort of, you know, might be disappointed in myself with, but nonetheless, I hope my rider knows my name. I hope that the person that I'm in intimate relationship with, or I hope that God knows who I am and knows my name. As the song goes on and I get to you know, the third verse, and I'm sort of in the valley of the shadow of death, and I'm facing, you know, the future, and I'm facing the abyss, it turns into not I know my rider knows my name, but I hope my rider knows my name, because ultimately I have doubts, right? And and I wonder, you know, is God watching me? Does God know my name? Or if I'm talking about human relations, can we really communicate with each other? You know, are we really able to see each other and to hear each other and to hold each other? Sometimes I don't know. And so I hope we do. I hope my rider knows my name. But I'm not sure that I know that, you know, all the time.
That literally sounds like it epitomizes the concept of wrestling.
Yes. Yeah, I think so.
It's like that should be the theme song for Tishrei. Like, that's everything that I feel in the ramp up through Elul to Tishrei. That's for those of you who don't keep any of these holidays yet. That Elul Tishrei vibe is this hurry up and wait feeling of let's clean up, let's shine up, let's take stock, let's evaluate. And then hold on, wait a minute. Uh-oh. Now we're actually being judged. Uh-oh.
Yeah.
We don't know entirely how the outcome's going to be. And it's that sensation of I want, I need, I desire, I drive, I strive. And then, oh man, I hope I did it.
I hope I did it. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I can feel certain at some point, right?
Yeah.
I can feel certain about it. But then it's like when I get there, you know, or I face mortality or the darkness or whatever, it's like, I'm not so certain now. I hope, but I don't know. I don't know.
That's incredible. What a great, I need to listen to the song. Which album is it on?
It's on the new album that just came out. The album's called Cordelia.
Okay.
You can find it on all streaming platforms.
I'm excited.
Yeah, it's the very first song.
Amazing. So what do you hope that your readers will take away from the book, and how do you hope that it changes the way they engage with Torah?
Well, I hope that the, you know, my readers take away from the book that, you know, that whatever they believe, okay, they're religious, they're not religious, whatever, it doesn't matter to me. But, you know, our classic texts, which have, you know, grown far beyond Judaism. I mean, I understand that the Bible is like the world's bestseller or something like that, but
and followed immediately after by the IKEA catalog. That is not
right.
Statistic.
Exactly. But that these, so, you're religious or you're not religious, you believe whatever you believe about these texts, but that these texts can be a really valuable tool for sort of helping us to unpack whatever questions we may have about what we see in the world, what we see in ourselves. But that you have to really engage with them on a deep level. I mean, I think that's why we still read them and we still wrestle with them, because because the text has been useful in that way. And so I hope that people see that they can take the text seriously. If they're afraid that it's going to make them religious, well, let's not worry about that, right? Maybe it will, but they can find themselves in the text, I believe, and that they'll see in my book. Hopefully, they'll see that, that's the work that I've been engaged in, is trying to find myself in the text and try to answer questions that I have, and that they can use the text in the same kind of way.
What you're describing is recognizing that you might be reflected in that text, even if it's not in a great way.
That's right.
That's a shade of humanity too.
Oh, for 100%. 100%.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So I am curious, because for those of you who are only listening, Ethan is getting his steps in, bless him. And he's walking around what appears to be an immense library, kind of like Hogwarts. And I see Judaica on the walls everywhere.
For sure.
And so much beautiful, awareness surrounding him, completely enveloping him in Jewish identity on all sides. And so now I'm curious, can you give me one Jewish tradition or a Jewish value or a Jewish experience that holds deep meaning for you, and why?
One Jewish value that holds meaning for me, I think it's this. I mean, people come to me, I'll give you two questions that people ask me, but I come to the same answer for them. Sometimes people come to me and they say, I want to study Kabbalah. I want to study esoteric, wisdom and esoteric knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, that's great, you should do that. I'm probably not your teacher for that. I have some experience with it, but I'm not. And I said, but it's great. But how about we live in this world? So, why don't we, figure out how to live better in this world rather than, I'm not, nothing against Kabbalah. I love it too, but let's live here. And, or people say, I want to be Jewish, right? I want to talk to you about converting. And, we have this principle in the Talmud that says people come, they want to convert, we're supposed to turn them away, right? Three times, right? I'm like, I don't turn them away, but I say this, I'm like, look, you don't have to be, first of all, you don't have to be Jewish, right?
Correct.
Just, you don't get any extra candy. You don't get to go to a different...
Oh, no, you just get extra jobs.
You get extra jobs. I said, you don't have to be Jewish. You just have to not be a jerk, you know?
Yes.
And not to say... And then I'm quickly saying, I'm not saying that you're a jerk. I'm just saying, the whole thing is, which comes back to living in this world, is you just have to be a human being and to treat other people that you meet like human beings. People say to me, it's easy for you to say this or say that, you live in a nice house, you have a nice life, you're pretty well off. And I say, yeah, but you could be living under a bridge, have nothing, and you're going to meet somebody else. And the question is, even there under that bridge, are you going to treat that other person like a human being, or are you going to not treat them like a human being? We all have that ability. And I think ultimately that's what Judaism is about. You see, even your enemy struggling over there, his donkey, whatever that may be in our modern sensibility, is struggling. Your enemy is having some kind of struggle. Help his animal out, however you understand that, right?
Right.
It's a, why are you continuing to be a jerk to this guy? You know, he might be a jerk to you. I don't know. But the point is, it's like his donkey is struggling over there. Come on. What's wrong with you?
You know? So holding yourself to the highest standard that you can.
Holding yourself to the highest standard that you can. You know, you hear a story about a guy that is, you know, a religious guy, a frum guy. He wants to buy his wife flowers before Shabbat. You know, time is running out. You know, he's got to buy the flowers before time runs out and get home. But in the meantime, because he's in such a hurry, he's stepping over people in the grocery line. I mean, what's wrong with you? What? You know, those are human beings too. Don't step on people in the grocery line. I mean, yes, your wife is important. The flower is important. It's important to
I'm get sure all that was in Beersheba in Israel, like last Friday.
Last Friday. Sure. Exactly. Like 100 times.
100%.
You know, so treat people like a human being, you know.
That which is loathsome to you, do not do to your fellow.
Don't do to your fellow. Exactly.
So it's not that it's a pet peeve of mine, but it's just something that so frequently comes up in conversations that I have with people, that there are just basic concepts that are inherently Jewish concepts. And yet people skip over them.
Oh, people
like,
skip
no,
over
no, no,
them
I'm going to learn Gemara today. No, no. You're going to be respectful and polite to your neighbor down the street. That's what you're going to do.
That's what,
like, it's like, we don't need to be high-minded when we're omitting the base foundational concepts first.
That's right.
Very simple, straightforward stuff.
Sure.
Now, I am also a little curious.
Sure.
I know that with the book, the way that you wrote it, and I mean, obviously it's got a controversial title, controversial subject matter. Yeah. I also am aware that you wrote it in a non-traditional, not conventional writing style.
Yeah.
And I find that fascinating as an author myself. I would love to know a little bit about what kind of style is it, and how did you decide to do that style?
Well, it's, you know, I call it like kind of broken poetry. And how I developed, I mean, I think being a songwriter, first of all, of course, doing more academic writing when I was back in graduate school, or you know, for work, I have to pay attention to grammar and you know, all that. With this, it really started with the previous book, where I had all these notes from different chavrusas, and I had it in my mind.
Learning partnerships for folks.
Learning partnerships, and I had it in my mind that I would organize all these notes at some point over the years. And when COVID hit, I didn't have anything to do but organize all these notes from these. But I didn't want to write an academic piece on all of them. So I decided, you know what I'll do is I'll write it in this kind of broken poetry. I'll take the William S. Burroughs approach to writing. I'll cut the Torah and the tradition up into little bits, throw it up in the air, stitch it back together, and see what happens and see what emerges. And so that's how the first book turned out. And so the first book has a lot of different ideas, and it's written mostly in that broken poetry style. I wanted to have each line be like a breath. So if each line was only going to be like 3, 4, or 5 words, that's what I wanted. And then I wanted like half of the page to be blank so that you, the reader, could fill it in, complete the work. And then maybe someday we get a chance to meet and talk about, you know, what you discovered in the work. And so then when I did this book, I thought, well, that was a nice approach. I want to do that again. And this is obviously a much more focused book than the first one was, but I wanted to maintain that approach. I think that it was also, to me, from what I've heard, you know, from readers, is that it made it sort of more conversational. It made it more intimate. Maybe it made the subject matter somewhat less traumatic because it was like I was there with you in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And if that stuff is true, and I believe when people told me that it is true for them, then I think, well, that's good, because that's a healing thing. If you think that, you know, I'm not just writing some academic, you know, cold academic piece about all this trauma, I'm actually sitting there with you and we're discussing it. And maybe in poetry, it comes across more that way. And,
There's so many different reasons that I think that is such a clever way to invite people to give Torah a chance.
Yeah.
As you know, I was not a practicing Jew for a good chunk of my life. I've only been Bat Shuva for 7 years. And I was raised totally chiloni, totally non-religious by two Israeli parents. Dad's a Holocaust survivor. So I came to Judaism kind of in my 30s. And I really kind of hated Torah a lot at the beginning because I had either been misinformed. I had never really read it. I couldn't read Hebrew at the time. And a lot of obstacles were in my way. And I've noticed with a lot of my fellows who are not very observant, they're in the same situation. They know they're Jews. They know Torah is in their, you know, spiritual DNA, and they feel these speed bumps. And then you add on to it something like the concept of sexual violence, and the way that Chazal might address it, the way that the sages might address it, and it can feel incredibly hindering. And for you to write in that style to invite them to slowly digest this information, and that almost as though you're holding their hand through it, is so welcoming. It's so refreshing, because most of the time when you're a noob and you're reading anything from Torah, you feel like an ignoramus, like you need a rabbi sitting beside you just telling you what this one word means.
And
that's such a novel way to invite people to come closer.
Well, I think that's how it should be. I mean, I think that God wants, at least in my view, I think probably in yours as well, if I can speak for you, God wants an intimate relationship with the human being. And we, of course, we want intimate relationships with each other. We want to, as I was saying before, we want to really be able to see each other and hear each other and hold each other in our shared humanity. And so I think, you know, again, using Torah that way, or talking about Torah in that way, is helpful and healing, and hopefully breaks down those barriers, whether those barriers are real or just perceived. You know, it's we want to have that intimacy with each other, and we should be able to approach the text in that way.
I agree with you. It's interesting, because in my regular life, I'm a life coach, and I specialize in dating and relationships. And one of the things that comes up often when we talk about developing intimacy with our partner, or if it's a single person who's learning to get into dating and getting married and learning what intimacy ought to look like, there is this recurring theme of, I don't know what to do, and therefore I'm uncertain, and therefore I get afraid, and therefore the intimacy is garbage. That spirals into itself, and you end up with a negative feedback loop. And it's so interesting how, for some folks that, like myself and others that I've met, they have the same dynamic with learning Torah. And it's so kind of tragic that it ends up being that way. But that intimacy, you know, it's almost as though with this particular subject matter, since it's so deep and so difficult and so challenging, like, I tell people when I coach them, it's okay to pause in the middle right now.
Right.
Let's take a breath and hold on a second before we say the next thing, before we read the next thing, because our spiritual and physiological body needs time to metabolize this data.
Yeah.
And we can't receive that full mikubal, that full download of what we need to receive from this information, from this text, from this relationship, whatever, if we're rushing through this fear-based reaction.
That's right.
And it requires slowness.
Yeah.
And that's so lovely.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. No, it requires slowness. I mean, it occurs to me to say that, you know, the rabbi I mentioned earlier, one of the rabbis I study with, the one who's giving me smicha, Bene Lape, she does the opposite. Her approach to Talmud is the opposite of Daf Yomi. We've been learning a daf in Sanhedrin for like 2 years. We do like a word a month.
Whoa. You know? Talk about slowness.
Yeah.
Wow.
And
it's like,
and I remember this story. You know, it's a Buddhist story about, there was some monk, you know, whatever, thought, and who knows if this is a real story or not.
Somewhere on a mountain.
Some monk somewhere in China. And, you know, everybody's rushing around, you know, so this monk, his discipline was to walk as slowly as possible. And he was so, you know, adept at walking slowly that no one could keep up with him.
That's funny.
You know, and so that's it's funny. Like, you know, Binet like reads, she's like that monk, but in the, but you know, in the Talmud sense of it, where it's like, we've been on this word for a lot, you know, we do a word a month. I mean, it's like, you know, so.
Holy, I can't imagine how long it would take to get through all of Gemara if you go at that speed.
Oh, it'd be like the age of the universe.
I know, right? You know? Oh my gosh.
Right.
Maybe exactly. That's how Hashem tells time.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. Maybe so. It could be.
So we are at the top of the hour. Like I said, I wanted to be respectful of your time. I am so incredibly grateful that I had an opportunity to chat with you. You're so interesting.
Stories
and the perspective on things. I just adore it. I did have one final question, if you will indulge me. Can you share one piece of insight or wisdom with the Jewish world at large? What would it be?
One insight or one piece of wisdom with the Jewish world at large. We have, you know, we do have, and I believe this, you know, sincerely, we do have a charge as Jews to bring light to the world. I'm not saying that we always live up to that. I mean, oftentimes, unfortunately, we don't. We're human. We're humans, yeah. You know, like anybody else, right? But we do have that as our mission. Then, of course, there have been times, and we've contributed so much to civilization, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the legal system, the whole idea
of a 7-day work week.
A 7-day work week, you know, right, exactly. But the whole idea that of courts and justice and all that is a Jewish idea that goes back thousands of years, right? So, right. I mean, we have, we've made contributions to civilization that go far beyond our numbers, right?
Absolutely.
And affect most of the people in the world are not Jewish, right? But these things we've contributed. So we have these things to bring to the world.
Mm.
You know, we have to, and we have this charge, and it's up to each of us individually and collectively to participate in that.
Mm-hmm.
But to be able to do that, to be able to know how to be a human being, we have to engage with our texts in a serious way. Again, you're religious, you're not religious, that's up to you. That's, I don't care about that, right? But in order to actualize these things, in order to be fully a human, in order to not be a jerk, in order to bring that light to the world, you have to engage seriously with the texts and traditions. And I think that's, to me, I haven't really found a better way of doing those kind of things. So, you know, grab a hold of the texts, find a study partner, and find all the things that make you really unhappy about the text.
Start with the stuff you want to kvetch about.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah. I love that. That's brilliant. Oh my goodness. I could talk your ear off for an hour, but I'm going to close us out. Everyone, thank you again for listening into How Do You Jew, the podcast that highlights the diversity of the Jewish experience. I hope that you enjoyed this as much as I did. This was fantastic. And remember, it doesn't matter how you Jew. It just matters that you Jew the best way that you can. All that we need to do is love each other and respect each other so we can get Mashiach already, because I really want to go see what the Beit HaMikdash looks like. And I have people I'm waiting to see, and we need to get this done. So less judging, more loving, and stay tuned. We're going to have more guests, God willing, soon. So thank you again, everyone. And thank you so much, Ethan, for being here. Have a fantastic week.
And thanks for having me.
Guys, later. Bye-bye.
Bye.